from Toronto. It's time for your weekly dose of conservation information here on Canada's All Environmental News Hour. On behalf of CIUT 89.5 in Toronto and our fantastic community radio partners across the country, I'm Darren Kaster, and welcome to the Green Majority. This week, we'll try again for Ian Taves, producer of Nature of Inspiration. That was actually my error. I thought we had him on last week, but in all the excitement, we made a mistake. So he's actually going to be joining us this week for real, we promise. That's director Ian Taves again of the Nature of Inspiration, which is a CBC television documentary channel documentary. Nature of Inspiration follows a variety of Canada's best visual artists in various locations around the country, discussing how their work relates to nature and the environment. We speak to Ian right after the national and international headlines. And then following that, in the second half, we'll have Joe Pavelka. Joe Pavelka is a instructor who teaches out of Calgary on the issue of ecotourism, which I thought was very interesting. That was courtesy of Alternatives Journal. So we'll be speaking with him about ecotourism and about some of his classes in the second half of the program. However, all that and more is coming up. But first, I have Graham Carey joining me with our headlines.
Thanks, Darren. On Monday, July 30th, former Canadian Environment Minister David Anderson joined the growing opposition to the proposed Northern Gateway pipeline. Anderson expressed concerns with the benefit to Canada, as well as concerns with Calgary-based Enbridge, who, in his words, was the last company in North America that should receive permits for the pipeline contract, mainly due to a long history of spills and environmental negligence on the part of Enbridge. The most recent of the Enbridge spills occurring on Friday, July 27th, was in Wisconsin. The $6 billion twin pipeline project would export bitumen oil deposits from Alberta to British Columbia and then on to expanding Asian markets. BC Premier Christy Clark and critics agree that the province of Alberta would receive the majority of economic benefits while BC takes on the environmental hazards. And now on to your international environmental headlines. From denier to supporter, one of science's biggest skeptics of human-produced climate change is now a firm believer. Climate scientist Professor Richard Muller admits in a New York Times opinion piece he is a converted skeptic on July 28th. He says that a new study focused at looking into a non-believer's concerns helped in his turnaround. Muller is the co-founder of Berkeley Earth Surface Temperature, or BEST, project, a group that used to dispute the magnitude and causes of global warming. However, after last year's extensive study, the former skeptic team and Muller concluded that climate change is happening and humans are to blame. According to their evidence, the average temperature of the Earth's land has risen by 2 degrees Fahrenheit over the past 250 years, including an increase of 1 degree over the most recent 50 years. Further, the team determined that the latter temperature rise was due mostly to human activity. America's most polluted lake is getting a water makeover. Onondaga Lake in Syracuse, New York, has been subjected to decades of sewage from the greater city area and a century's worth of toxic metals like mercury, solvents, and PCBs caused by commercial dumping. However, Honeywell International has started a five-year, $450 million project to clean the nation's dirtiest lake. Dredging machinery started suctioning the 185 acres of sediment from the lake bottom on July 30th. The removal is expected to yield up to 10 feet of toxic sludge and as much as 20 pounds of mercury, which has plagued the water for over 60 years. They will also cap another 400 acres of lake bottom. The project is in progress 24 hours a day, 6 days a week, and won't cease until the winter months. Researchers have made the remarkable discovery of plants akin to palm trees thriving in Antarctica and saying they may return again. A team of scientists retrieved fossilized pollen of the tropical plants from seabed sediment around the continent. The ancient palm trees have been pegged at existing 52 million years ago. This was during the Eocene era, where temperatures in Antarctica range between a balmy 10 to 25 degrees Celsius. Details of the research have been published in the journal Nature. One of the authors, Dr. James Bendel from the University of Glasgow, says that carbon levels are rising rapidly through the use of fossil fuels and deforestation. Bendel adds that if the continent's ice melts, it can raise global sea levels by 60 meters, which would have catastrophic effects globally. He concludes his sobering message with the idea that the Earth may be shifting into a climate similar to the Eocene era due to human activity. And those are all your national and international headlines for today. I'm Graham Carey.
Thank you very much, Graham. We will have Joe Pavelka coming up to talk about ecotourism in the second half. However, right after this music break, we'll be joined by producer and director of The Nature of Inspiration on CBC's documentary channel, which is Ian Taze. We'll be right back. We are back. I have should have Ian Taves on the line. Are you there, Ian?
I have kind of a bad signal here. I'm not sure why.
Oh, we'll see what we can do about that. Can you hear me all right?
Well, I can. It's a bit sort of rattly, but
all right. Well, hopefully we'll see what we can do about that in the time being. I'll see what we can do here. So, obviously, we've had you on the program before. This is for a similar project that was for a previous project with the CBC CBC documentary channel. But today we're talking about The Nature of Inspiration.
Right.
And this is something where you've gone and interviewed several prominent Canadian visual artists of all types and talked to them about how their work relates to the environment. Is that roughly correct?
That is correct, yes.
So do you want to tell us a little bit about, I guess, where even just the idea for the project in the first place came from?
Well, it's kind of like we went backwards. We had done a series for five seasons for Bravo called Landscape as Muse. And through the course of that, we'd interviewed 51 Canadian artists. There was an extensive sort of archive of unused material and particularly interviews, you know, 4 and 5 and 6 hour interviews that we one time sort of sat around and realized, you know, there's some excellent stuff in here, and there maybe there's another way to approach a new project. So the new project was just a kind of a refinement of all that material and refocusing of ideas. I also conducted new interviews with those same artists, with almost all of them, so I added another 5 or 6 hours to each of them, so there's quite a pile to pull through.
So there's been a theme. We've spoken to you, I believe, I'm pretty sure this is the second time we've spoken to you, but both projects, obviously, because you were on the program, were had an environmental kind of frame of reference for them. So I see you're really taking that to heart, and that we're even recycling to the extent of some of the old materials sitting around in the CBC archives there. But yeah, you're putting sustainability into real practice there, Ian. I think that's the story.
Sure.
So do you want to talk a little bit about some of the artists that you chose to use here and maybe some of the experiences of going back and re-interviewing them? I see some of the names here just off the top of the... There's Edward Bertinsky and media artist Marlene Creates and a few other names here. Were some of the people that you decided to choose for this project?
Yeah, there was 9 of them. Out of the 51 we had originally used in the other show, we kind of looked at the interviews, what was already there, what they had said, and what they might say again. Some of them we were revisiting after 6 or 7 years. I wish it were different, but it seems to me that the older ones were just a little more wise. So that there tends to be a bit of a skew towards the older, more established artists.
Okay.
They just have a lot of wisdom. I mean, one guy in particular, Tacton Abbey from Vancouver Island, he's 86 years old. I mean, the guy's been painting since the 50s.
Wow.
I mean, what a wealth of information and ideas, right? So how can you choose somebody, sort of younger over a guy like him, right? There was just so much, more interesting sort of stories and historical sweep to his work.
Absolutely. And did you find, I mean, in general, when we're talking about artists, I'm very much a non-artist sort of person. I like, organizing things and that sort of whatnot. I'm the other side of the brain. But I do very much appreciate art. And one of the things I think that people generally associate when you kind of take some stereotypes and take kind of a stereotype of an artist and then a stereotype of people who are interested in the environment, you probably end up with if you close your eyes and imagine it, you probably end up with some sort of... guy in Birkenstocks wearing cutoff pants and all this sort of thing. But it seems, I get the idea that this would be a very philosophical piece and that the combination of kind of the backgrounds of these interests and then also the age of these being kind of established artists. How far did you get as far as just talking about even just like philosophy of environment and that sort of thing? You said there was a lot of wisdom. Like what types of things did the artists choose to talk about?
Oh yeah, no, I think that's just it. I mean, the main thrust of our interviewing was, well, it was two kind of, there's numerous questions, and they get very philosophical. We go into these kind of tangents, and they're really just, they're just conversations. They're conversations with a, kind of wide-eyed guy on one end of it, that's me, and then these wise sages on the other side of the camera, which is the artist. They talk a lot about the scope of their career and perseverance through career. I mean, the ups and downs, how to make art, how to continue to make art when everything is kind of, a lot of times, a lot of things are pushing against that, which just seems to be a metaphor for maybe the environment movement in a way. To, being a sustainable person in Canada these days with the political winds blowing the way they're blowing, it seems like it's quite an uphill battle, frustrating battle. And I think the artists can sort of teach us that. And more specifically, all of them work in nature or landscape, so we have a sort of shared philosophy that way.
If I can get on my soapbox for a minute, we did an interview very recently, actually, where we talked a lot about the kind of philosophy and the idea of just kind of how important community is to anyone who's would either identify themselves as an activist or just an interested person in the environment, because there are so many challenges. That idea of having community around you is giving you something, the strength and the courage to keep on doing it. I would just see that something about like artwork would be a very intensely personal and yet mass media way of kind of sharing that sense of community.
Yeah, I think your phone was just breaking up a bit there still. Are you hearing me clearly? Is that working?
Yeah, actually, we're hearing you just fine. And so I'll just repeat the question. Basically, I was just asking about the idea of like whether they saw this as sort of a sense of doing their art was almost a way of spreading community around environmental issues in any way, or if this was mostly just that art was the inspiration for it.
I think so. I think one guy in particular speaks to that quite specifically, and which is Peter von Thiessenhausen from Alberta. He speaks a lot about, it's a little more cryptic. He talks about sort of sending messages out into the world in a way with his art, and that gets into more Eastern philosophies, I suppose, about just you reap what you beget, what are the words I'm looking for. You sort of get back what you give out, and his art is part of that.
Perhaps you were looking for reap what you sow.
sort of, but it's not quite what you saw. But you know what I mean. He just has a belief that the art has a way of touching people in very small ways, kind of like the butterfly effect. It's just a very small gesture can have a huge resonance across massive distances.
Sure. I've actually got a quote from Peter von Thyssen. Is that what he said?
Thyssenhausen,
yeah. It says, art is creation, thereby unifying yourself with all other creation and becoming connected to the divinity that dwells within us all. I think that kind of sums up what you were getting at there.
Much better than I could, yes.
I was cheating, of course, quoting him directly. But no, I think the idea here is obviously, I think a lot of Canadian artists, I mean, artists in general, but specifically with my limited knowledge of art and Canadian art specifically, nature has always been, and I think will always be because of our national identity, one of the strongest possible places for inspiration. I think, I mean, it is for most artists in general, but specifically for Canadian artists. I mean, when you think of classical pieces, Group of Seven and all this sort of thing. Did you get into any conversations with any of these artists about them?
I'm still losing you there. Are you there at all?
Oh yeah, we can, we're getting you a little bit rough there, but I can still sort of hear you. Can you hear me there?
I got you a bit now, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry about that, folks out there in audio land, just having a little bit of trouble with the phone line today. I'll ask again that with nature being a source of inspiration for the actual artwork, did you speak to any of the artists who talked about in any way using any in sustainability ideas in the actual production of their art, either trying to find less toxic paints or anything as far as the actual production of the art from an environment standpoint, or was it just mostly that this was a sense of inspiration for them?
I have to apologize. I got the last sentence or two there, and the rest was all kind of noise. Darn.
Okay, sorry. Wait,
now you're good.
I'll try one more time. We'll see if we can sneak it out there. We were just wondering if you found any of the artists who had incorporated sustainability into the actual production of their art rather than just using nature as an inspiration.
Oh, that's a really good question. I think again, Mr. Thyssenhausen is one who tends to do a lot of that. He tends to recycle materials, use found materials, natural materials as well, so there's not a really ecological footprint, using wood and ice sometimes. Yeah, I think he was one example of that. I would say Dempsey Bob is another one. He uses local trees that are sort of harvested in a very simple way, and they're carved into masks. Agonisa Dick using bees, which is a whole other, that's another level of discussion as well. I mean, she's using bees to make art. They help her make sort of sculptural pieces. But in addition, in a sort of a small way, she's a supporter of bees. And bees, as we all know, are of critical importance to the survival of our entire planet.
Absolutely.
So I mean, hers is art where the bees sort of crawl over found objects, and crawl over pieces of paper, using tiny sculptural pieces. So there's certainly really no ecological footprint, and she brings a certain awareness. So I suppose the awareness that she brings to bees is part of a contribution in a positive sense. John Chalk, a ceramic artist, also basically just harvesting clay and turning that into fine ceramic work. A lot of the glazes he uses are made from just ash and those kind of natural elements. So there's quite a sustainable point to his work. And even his kilns are wood-fired. They're sort of hand-built Japanese-inspired kilns. The wood that he burns is basically fallen wood on his acreage. So certainly some of them are quite explicitly using sustainable practices in their work, and others, of course, just believe strongly in sustainability and they spread the message. You think of a guy like Ed Bertinsky with his kind of reach in the art world. I mean, the way that his work resonates everywhere and on the globe. I mean, his paintings are all over the world. Everybody knows who he is. He's quite famous. So then you start to ask yourself, well, what's the message here? I mean, if Ed shows you, a 6x12 photograph of a copper mine that, arrests you in such a way that you're driven to action, well, there's a value to that. And even though he had to use chemicals to make that print, maybe, you know what I mean? There's sort of a trade-off there.
Definitely, yeah.
In terms of the educational power of his work. Yeah, it's a great discussion point. I mean, that's one that we did. It's certainly in various times and tangents in our interviews with all of these guys, we discussed that process as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, again, I apologize to both to our guest and to our listeners. We are having a bit of trouble with the phone today. So I think, Ian, I'm just going to try and shorten my question as much as possible. We've got enough time for one more. So my last question before we're going to let you go today is just what's next on your project list? We've got a couple of strong environment projects.
I think I've lost you again there. Now you're back. As soon as you stop talking, it kind of clears off.
We're just wondering what's next for you. What's your next project going to look like?
Oh, what's next? We're in the middle of a show that we've been doing. It's our second season. It's called Untamed Gourmet, and it's a show about wild and gathered food. Chefs basically across Canada who go out with, some of them are Aboriginal, but others go out with Aboriginal guides, and they look at traditional food gathering techniques through Aboriginal eyes as well as their own sort of culinary training. Gather, hunt, fish, trap. However they get food, they use it, and then they make a gourmet meal out of that. And it's in its second season on television on APTN.
Great.
Turned from PEI, and we gathered clams and oysters and lobster and various greens from the beaches and made a beautiful feast there.
And that sounds great. So the Nature of Inspiration, if people want to catch that, that is going to be on August 4th, which is, if you're listening live here in Toronto, that's tomorrow. But Saturday, August 4th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and also going to be repeated at Sunday, August 5th, which is 2 days from now. August, if you're listening live, however, which is August 5th at 8 p.m. So that's August 4th at 6 and August 5th at 8. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ian Taves, if you can hear me.
Always a pleasure. I think it's my point to talk because I can't hear because of the line. But always a pleasure. Thanks. And hello to Toronto.
Thank you so much. All right. Have a great day. Okay, so again, sorry for a little bit of trouble there, folks, but we should be fine from now on. We're going to go take another break, and then we'll be back with our other feature, which was I spoke earlier this week to Joe Pavelka. Joe Pavelka is a professor from Calgary who actually teaches a class on ecotourism. I was introduced to Joe via an article out of Alternatives Journal, which is a great magazine that helps find us some stories from time to time. So we'll be speaking with Joe Pavelka, ecotourism expert, right after this music break.
Loving the dirty things you do, loving your cleanliness of truth, hating the way I always don't, sending you all those folded notes. Tell me why I act so childish when you're I raise high. day I die. And even beyond that.
All right, welcome back. If you're just tuning in, this is Darren Kaster with the Green Majority. You can find us online at greenmajority.ca. You can also find us on YouTube. You can also find us on Twitter at Green Majority. You can also find us on Facebook. You can find us just about everywhere. Different things for different things. Obviously, the Twitter feed, what happens is we post out a lot of the stories for our news headline consideration. So that's a good way to get just a stream of links and the occasional important announcement, but basically just a stream of links to Canadians specifically and then some international news stories based on the environment. So that's good for that. If you want to be part of our little community, you can go to our Facebook page. We have a good conversation that goes on there about the episodes of the show that get put up. Also, that is the venue by which I like to post amusing photographs and other amusing material that I find on the interwebs. There's frequently stories that I'll forward on from places like Environmental Defense and Sierra Club Canada. And when I find amusing cartoons and that sort of thing, I like to post them up there. So if you're feeling social or want to find some amusing pictures, definitely join our Facebook feed. If you have a question or comment about the show, you can also email us at thegreenmajority@gmail.com. I don't know about anyone else, but I love getting email from strangers, unless it's trying to get me to buy something. However, if you're not looking to sell me something, please do send the show email. I love hearing from you, even if it's just keep up the work, good work, great job. I'd like it slightly less, but still like it if you said you're doing a terrible job. Here's some ways when you can improve. Not a fan at all of saying you're doing a terrible job and no comments, Ryan. Yeah, it's good. It's good when they say they don't like something, when they give us a suggestion of how to improve. But anything you might have to say to us, we'll read it all. And so that's our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, some stuff up on YouTube, although we're going to be producing that a little bit more in the future. That's kind of that project's a little bit on hold at the moment. We're also listening. You can listen to us in traditional manners, for instance, on the 17 campus and community radio stations in cities across the country, from Vancouver, BC to St. John's, Newfoundland. You can listen live nationwide on channel 826 of the Shaw Direct Satellite Network or on channel 946 of the Rogers Digital Channel platform. You can also get an audio copy or podcast of the program on our website at greenmajority.ca, which is, however, temporarily on hiatus. We've had some website trouble recently, so please, for the time being, feel free to interact with us via our Facebook page. We're going to get that website back up as soon as we can, but there has been some issues with that. So for the time being, we're Solon's website. Unless you're looking for my very polite apology that saying that our website is down, then you can go to our website and that's what you will receive there. We're going to move on now to our second feature for the day. This is an interview I did earlier this week with Joe Pavelka, who is an ecotourism expert. This interview was given to us courtesy of Alternatives Journal, so I'd just like to give them a shout out and a thank you very much as well for connecting me with Joe. However, without further ado, take it away with Joe Pavelka. So today I will be speaking with Joe Pavelka. He is an associate professor and coordinator of the Bachelor of Applied Ecotourism and Outdoor Leadership Program at Mount Royal University in Calgary. Welcome to the Green Majority, Joe.
Thank you very much, Dan.
So I picked up your article today in Alternatives Journal. It's called Turismo Alternativo. That's my really bad mangling of the pronunciation. Basically, we're talking ecotourism today. So I just first of all wanted to start off if there's anything else you wanted to add about your background.
Well, I'm an associate professor and the coordinator of the Bachelor's in Applied Ecotourism and Outdoor Leadership here at Mount Royal University. So as an associate professor here, I do quite a bit of work in Latin America, but also in Western Canada as well.
Awesome. So the article today that I was picking up in Alternatives Journal was written by you, and this describes a trip or a few trips, I guess, that you've taken down. You take some students to the Amazon, for instance. And one of the things that I wanted to kind of start with was that you start with some very descriptive language about the mystery and all this, the nature description. So you've gotten very, very detailed into that. And then one of the first things you start with after this beautiful kind of description of the nature of the Amazon is how incredibly difficult even just defining ecotourism is. I was wondering if you could just tell me a little bit more about what is ecotourism and then why do you find it hard to define?
That's a very good point. So,
well, perhaps you might have to do it in the other order, I suppose.
It's a difficulty that we have had in our field since its inception. So, and it really hasn't been around for that long, but One of the problems that we have within ecotourism is that it is easy for us to define ourselves theoretically, more difficult for us to define ourselves operationally. And, of course, we, like so many other areas, phenomena, I guess, deal with that greenwashing. So when ecotourism was first launched, everyone wanted to be a part of it. How do you decide who is and who isn't? It's very difficult. You know, how would I decide if I was to walk around Toronto or Calgary, you know, could I slap a green label on someone's forehead to say that they're a certified environmentalist or not? You know, there's too many shades of green.
Yeah, you akin it to, in the article, to the frustration of trying to nail jelly to the wall, which I thought was really descriptive.
Exactly. So, there are many, many different definitions of ecotourism, and in general, though, what we understand is that it is tourism that is sustainable and that supports local people, local culture, and the environment, as well as social structures in the best way that it can. And beyond that, it's very difficult to attach numbers or any sort of quantifiable measures to it.
Well,
groups have tried.
So we can stick away from trying to quantify it, but
sure.
just in your kind of your sense as someone who studies and teaches on this topic, just in your own kind of personal sense from your experience, what kind of proportion would you say there is the balance between maybe ecotourism that's hard to define, or maybe, you know, some stuff that's called that maybe that's not the right label for it, out of kind of a general either misunderstanding or you know, just things that don't fit your definition versus people outright actually trying to deceive and play and kind of greenwash and get away with, you know, getting extra business by slapping the word green or eco next to
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Well, I think that problem was much more apparent in the early 2000s. I think now what we're starting to see is, I would say that it is not that common. So it is much more rare for us to encounter organizations or companies that claim to be ecotourism that are not. It's much more rare, much more common back in the early 2000s. Why that occurred, I could speculate, but I really don't know. But it is actually getting to be much better now. I think it's a part of the maturing of that sector, I think.
So, I mean, even just kind of off the cuff of it, I've seen a few, you know, ads for some Canadian and some international ecotourism in the past. Over the past few years, I've just kind of noticed an ad here and an ad there on various websites that I frequent. And one of the things that kind of caught me right off, because I'm just kind of naturally a cynical guy a little bit, is that, you know, right off the bat, it'll say, you know, beautiful eco tour for, you know, $3,000 whatever dollars, blah, 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 blah. And then it first starts off in the description with, first we fly you to, and I'm like, already you've lost me. Because I was like, well, it's not terribly to fly in. I mean, really the eco thing to do is not to leave your home. So I guess how, if from the, we can, you know, put aside the people who are trying to maybe deceive or you know, somewhat play up the eco side of it for business practices. And we'll stick for now to the people who are genuinely trying to make a difference. Mm-hmm. When you're dealing with something that's kind of almost inherently unenvironmental, what sort of ways are these companies and families making sustainable? How do you make travel and tourism sustainable in general?
You raise an excellent point, Darren, and I'll tell you why. So in the article for Alternative Journal, one of the two families that I highlighted is the Huamani family, and the Huamani family has an operation in the Amazon. And I should tell you and your viewers, we have a really nice little film on that as well, and I'll give you the link to that later. But the Huamani family is a really good example of that, in so much as they have carved out this, and by carved out, they've staked a claim to 12,000 hectares of land in the jungle. What they're doing is they're running an ecotourism operation which is supporting their very large extended family. And their father originally went to that piece of land back in the 80s, and he, like everyone else, was going to slash and burn, and he was going to get into logging and farming. His kids later on, once, which is actually Rise, once they went to school and they started to realize that there were some alternatives, they set up their ecotourism business. One of the things that I tell people when they raise the whole flying argument, and I'll tell you, flying is not good, and I understand that. Flying has clear negative impact, and there's no way that I would argue that. What I do argue is the trade-off. When you look at families like the Wadis up in the Andes in Peru and the Huamanis in the Amazon, they will earn a living one way or another. They will do it. And the Huamanis in the Amazon are actually, I think, showing a lot of other families that you do not necessarily need to slash and burn and set up olives or set up something else, and that you can actually run a business, a very good business, take care of your extended family, and leave 12,000 hectares of Amazon rainforest intact. In order to do that, you need Western money. You need Western tourists, because obviously they couldn't finance this via Peruvians. So here's the trade-off, and it's not an easy trade-off, but the trade-off is if you fly, which is not good for the environment, if you take part in activities such as this, and I don't want to narrow it down and be one of those sort of righteous guys, but in activities similar to this, what we're doing in this case is we are financing operations that actually keep this part of the Amazon intact. So, you know, it's a trade-off. It's not clean, but it's definitely something that I think people need to understand.
Definitely. And I think, I mean, another factor there too is that probably the proportion of people, the proportion of people who are going on these types of trips, I would feel just kind of instinctively that the majority of them are people that maybe, you know, were talked out of a trip to the Bahamas and went to Peru to do ecotourism instead. So we're not even necessarily adding extra trips. We're just perhaps putting those trip dollars to more ecological use as well. So I think, yeah, there's a number of factors. There. One of the things that you outline here as well was that between, for Peru specifically, between 2003 and 2008, that visitors to Peru doubled. And you attribute this, a lot of that, to things like the Lonely Planet. And I just wanted to ask you, do you feel that, the numbers seem to speak for themselves in the case of Peru, but just kind of overall, do you feel like over the past decade, we've had a more kind of a general awakeness of people just being aware of the environmental impact of their actions, and then that possibly is a cause for the rise in ecotourism?
I think so. There's a lot of literature out there that would speak to the rise of consciousness in around life politics, etc., and how something like ecotourism factors into life politics. And I do agree with that. I think, though, you know, it is interesting, though, because you know, me as an academic, I will often go down there and I spend a lot of time with operators, and sometimes I think I have the answers and I can say, yes, you know, guys, it's all about life politics. And then the operators will come back to me and say, actually, not at all. We see people who just want a different, authentic experience. And I think, okay, so, you know, there's a little bit of awareness. There's awareness in and around environmental issues, clearly. And I think the typical tourist today is much more enlightened than 10 years ago. Having said that, there is this insatiable appetite, I think, for the exotic and the different, and I think that ecotourism does represent that in some ways. Certainly not only ecotourism, but it's in that arena.
Absolutely. It's funny, actually, that I mentioned Barbados there for a second, or the Bahamas, because you actually have an update right at the end of the article there talking about some of the ecotourism in some of the, say, maybe we can call it more traditional tourist spots as well.
Yeah.
Some of the more kind of fun and the places you'd associate with sort of fun in the sun and going and getting unlimited bar and that sort of thing, a very common kind of Western vacation, that even places like that are starting to pick up this concept of at least in incorporating some aspect of sustainability, if not outright full ecotourism as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see, and I think that's absolutely wonderful. So, you know, you will have purists in our field of ecotourism who will who will disregard the Royal York Hotel in Toronto and say, well, you know, clearly that's on ecotourism. But, you know, those hotels actually do a lot to be more environmentally sustainable and more socially sustainable. And if a movement such as ecotourism can push, can sort of raise that watermark for all of the operators to do more, then I think that that's absolutely wonderful. Are all-inclusives in Cuba ever going to be ecotourism? I highly doubt it. I highly doubt it. Can that sort of consciousness raise them to be better? I certainly hope so, and we do see that as well.
And I think, I mean, there's definitely, this is one of those issues where there's a heavy influence of the concept that gets brought up in environment and activism in general a lot, which is the concept of voting with your dollars, which is that not only is there kind of a benefit of, giving less advantaged places where maybe, you know, people are, they're slashing and burning, not because they don't care about the environment, but because they literally just need to eat. And to providing a basis for an industry where they'll happily, you know, switch to doing something that's less ecologically damaging if there just was another option. But there's the, you kind of mentioned the other aspect of that as well, which is that, you know, big companies and big industry, if they see that environmental issues or that at least environmental sustainability is something that sells, we may have to stick on them a little bit to make sure that they're not just greenwashing it, then that it's actual genuine progress, but it's going to have an influence on that industry as a whole as well.
Oh, I agree. I agree completely. And so, more and more what we see is tourists, especially, I would say with all demographic cohorts, you know, beginning in around 25 and older, but with the younger mid-baby boomers, we are definitely seeing that they are asking more questions about environmental track records and even social track records. You know, the idea of fair trade within tourism, how do you treat your local employees, and are they getting a good wage, etc. So more and more questions like that is what I encounter actually probably in the last 5 to 7 years. Again, and I think that that's wonderful. I try and write articles like this and to do associated films, etc., to just get people to try and think about those things, because God knows I don't have all the answers, but that kind of discussion, I think, is a very good discussion.
Absolutely. So if people are interested in reading the article, we mentioned it's in Alternatives Journal. You can get that in a hard copy. They also have a great website. That's from the July, August, if you want to read the actual article. It gets into a lot of details of the families themselves. But Joe, before the interview, you mentioned you had some updates since the article reading.
So I managed to get an AUCC grant, which is Association of Canadian Colleges and Universities grant, to send three of my students down to the Andes for the summer, and they are working with the Wadi family, which is along the Salkantay Trail, and not just the Wadi family, but all of the families along the Salkantay Trail. And the short version of this story is that the Salkantay Trail is becoming recognized by the Peruvian government as the alternative to the Inca Trail into Machu Picchu, because of the growth. The Inca Trail really can't handle the growth. The conundrum is that once the trail becomes recognized and becomes controlled, as in you could only do it with approved guides, some of the local residents along the trail run the risk of being marginalized in this process where you have larger tour companies come in. We are working, so my three students are down there working in a community development manner with the families to try and get them better prepared, increase their capacity to put their own operations together and to be a part of that growth as opposed to being marginalized.
One of the other things that it kind of caught my eye about that, I want to ask you a little bit about your program, but the first thing that kind of jumped out at me was that I had never even heard of a program like that. We're here on the University of Toronto campus. To my knowledge, they don't have a comparable course there. How unique is that program, and what sort of, like, do you get people coming from all over Canada to participate in this program? What sort of response have you had?
Our program has been in operation ever since 2000, so we are heading into our 12th year, and we take 30 students a year, which is a very small intake, and we have about 100 and 10, 120 applications a year. Our applications are from Western Canada. We probably about 40% are from the rest of Canada, Ontario, Maritimes, etc. And then we probably have about three or four international students a year. As far as we know, it is unique to Canada. There are several programs that are similar, but no one has the exact same format as ours. It is it's a 4-year degree program, liberal arts based, and it has a combination of outdoor activity with strong academic and theoretical components as well. And then really, it's highly interdisciplinary. As the term suggests, ecotourism and outdoor leadership, highly, highly interdisciplinary. And that's the approach that we take.
Yeah, I'm working on some environment programs here at the University of Toronto as well, and it seems to be almost a ubiquitous implied concept that when you're dealing with anything having to do with the environment, it almost has to be a very kind of multidisciplinary way to look at it. I mean, I don't think you could really discuss the environment without getting into a wide range of topics. Pretty much every environment program here at the University of Toronto has various courses in various departments, and it seems to almost be necessary.
Well, I think one of the most exciting things to happen within the whole area of the environment, broadly defined, is that in the last decade or so, it has become recognized and acknowledged that it is highly interdisciplinary, and we're moving away from the dominance of the biological sciences, and now we're starting to move more towards the social sciences and even other perspectives. And yes, there are many, many other perspectives, but that is actually very exciting. And that gives rise to a program such as ours where we can approach these issues from a human point of view, from a commerce point of view. I mean, my goodness, to say something like, ecotourism and the whole commercial side and learning, proper business skills and marketing skills is going to help the environment. Was a little bit crazy a decade ago, and now I think it's much better accepted.
Yeah, if I can get on my soapbox for just a moment here, I would highly recommend anyone who's interested in studying anything having to do with the environment, whether you take Professor Pavelka's program here at the Mount Royal University in Calgary or any other program at your local university, please take at least one economics course because you're going to find it very difficult to convince anyone who's not already convinced if you don't know a little bit about how the economy works. And believe you me, take it from me, once you have a little bit of economic knowledge under your belt, there's some really strong arguments you can make.
I agree with you 100%. And I think, the two stories that I have in alternatives and a lot of the work we do is simply about understanding trade-offs. I always explain to people that arguments at either end of the spectrum tend to be unintelligent. So if you are 100% environmental, 100% pro-development, odds are you will have an unintelligent argument. You start to get into the middle and you start to understand trade-offs, and then you can formulate much more intelligent arguments. And that's really the essence of ecotourism. It's not, if someone wants to attack ecotourism, they can. And that's fine. It's really about understanding trade-offs and being comfortable with trade-offs in a genuine way.
Absolutely. Well, Joe, it's been a pleasure to have you on the Green Majority. I'm afraid that's all the time that we have. However, I would like to give you an opportunity to give the folks out there in Radioland a way to contact you, or if there's any other links either to your work or to the university, or if people have any questions, if you feel comfortable giving an email address, anything like that.
So first off, I would say there are two associated films with the article, and they can find them by going on to Vimeo and looking up my name, Joe Pavelka, on Vimeo. And there is the first one, which is In the Shadow of Machu Picchu, and the second one, which is Manu Park, Peru. And you can find them there. And anyone who wishes to contact me, they can simply contact me at jpavelka@mountroyal.ca.
Awesome. And unfortunately, we're still experiencing some website troubles, so we're not going to be able to put your name on our website for the time being. So just for people, I'll just spell your last name, of course, just to make sure people can get a contact of you. Joe is pretty self-explanatory, and Pavelka is P-A-V-E-L-K-A. Thank you so much for being on the Green Majority today, Joe.
Thank you very much.
Right. Nice pick for a song on the last track, Ryan. Who is that? We got to tell the listeners who that is. That's real catchy. And we're just having up. That's about all the time we have for today's show. Just wanted to wrap up. We're just going to Ryan was just going to jump on the mic here just to remind us all what they should be doing with their Wednesday evenings if they're within range of the Peel region in Ontario.
Oh, yeah. And that was Poison Pop Fizz, just so you know. No, wait. No, it wasn't. That was DVAS, Society Track.
Thank you very much. Yeah, that's catchy. So if people are within the Peel region every Wednesday, just remind them what they should be doing, Ryan.
Absolutely. Sitting at home, tuning into Rogers Cable 10 at 9 p.m. We have our show, Green Times in Peel. So it's live, so you can call in, join a discussion. We take environmental topics and discuss if they're actually feasible in everyday life.
Absolutely. And so that for the time being, you can only view that if you're within Peel region, which is in southern Ontario, if you're not from Ontario. But we hope that this is part of the step one in global takeover, I believe. So this down the road, I don't want to put a date on it, but down the road, we're going to be looking at that. We'll be viewed in every home nationwide, definitely.
That's right. We're definitely trying to figure out a way to stream it live so that anybody anywhere can see it, but
things are in the works. Things are in the works. Well, I mean, this is our first, I don't know, but I think you've been behind the camera before, but this is your first time on camera.
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken. So that's my first time on camera as well. So let's be honest. I mean, it's been pretty good, but we've hit some rough spots. You know, it's a learning curve.
Yes, the learning bumps.
Yeah, absolutely.
But if you want to see what Darren looks like, you got to travel to either Brampton, Mississauga, because he's hiding behind the mic all the time. So you got to get
that's
him exposed.
True. Ryan, you've been impressing me with some rather nice suits as well. So if you want to get a look at either of us, find your way into Peel Region on Wednesday night from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. Otherwise, stay tuned. We'll be hopefully finding a way to get that out to you or just await the world domination of Green Times. Will be slowly coming to a TV near you. That's in the works, future project. That is, however, all the time we have for today. As I said, we're running a little bit. It's been a little bit crazy around here. We've got some website troubles, this and that, audio troubles today. So lots of trouble, but don't you worry. We're not going anywhere. Green Majority will be around for a long, long time. We're going to hopefully get these technical issues sorted out for you as soon as possible. For the time being, that is all the time we have for today. As I said, technical production today was by Ryan Knight. Web hosting and bandwidth for our podcasting is provided by the web consulting firm rjgcreative.com with web production by Arlie Crawford. You can get an audio copy of today's program or a transcript of our news headlines, usually at greenmajority.ca. For the time being, you may have to delay, so stay tuned. You can look at greenmajority.ca for updated information, but as I said, we are having a bit of an issue with that at the time being. However, you can also email us at thegreenmajority@gmail.com if you're desperate for a copy of the show and can't get it off the website and it's not getting up anywhere else. Go ahead and email me directly and I'll see what I can do to get it to you. You've been listening to The Green Majority, Canada's all environmental news hour. Program is produced live at every Friday at CIUT 89.5 in Toronto and is available on campus and community stations from coast to coast. I'm Darren Kaster, and that's it for today's live edition of The Green Majority. Until next week, thanks for listening.